welcome to another episode of Horror Homeroom Conversations. I'm Elizabeth Irwin.
I'm Gwen Hoffman.
And on today's episode, we're talking queer visibility in horror films. From the tropes to representation to everything in between, we're asking what makes a good queer horror film and why are there so few of them? And as part of our Schools Out series, we're also counting down our top 10 favorite non-horror LGBTQ plus movies, so stay tuned. Okay, so I think when we were first talking about this, the initial idea was, okay, hey, we're going to do our top 10 favorite queer horror films. And right. Then I think we both realized pretty quickly that neither one of us has a top 10.
I would not get to 10.
I wouldn't get to 10 either.
I can promise you that.
And that's not to say that there are not 10 landmark horror films, but
not ones
that
like.
Are queer. But they're not ones that I like, exactly. And so I would feel a little bit disingenuous. So what we thought we would do is start by talking about maybe the state of queer horror and maybe about how it's evolved a little bit over the years. And then we're going to get into our list of favorite queer films. And sorry, guys, I don't think any of mine are horror. Are any of yours?
Not even close.
Not even close. So that's what you're dealing with on this episode today.
Before we kick these things off, again, I'm going to pour a little bit out for my homie because Dawn is not here today. Dawn,
so
I'm pouring liquids out on the floor for you to pay some homage to the fact that you are not here. So in spirit, you're here. We love you. We miss you. And we'll see you soon.
Yes, but we should preface by saying she's not here for all good reasons. She's not.
Because she's distanced herself from
very...
us. Yes.
Not even remotely. But, because that sounded very dire.
No, it's not dire. I just want to recognize that she's not here. She's one third of us. Like, she's 33.3 repeating percent of us.
I got news for you. She's more than that.
Yeah, but... she's at least a 33.4. She comes a little percentage above us, I think. She legitimizes
comes
us.
Ready to talk about all things horror, for sure. And I think that's part of why we decided to take this approach, at least for the month of June.
Yeah.
Because we knew that the three of us would not be able to get together to do an actual horror-centered podcast.
Right.
But we also didn't want to not have any content for June. So this seemed like a good compromise. And I think with it being Pride Month, it's important that we talk about queer visibility in film, both horror and non-horror. So in terms of queer horror, it has been quite the evolution. If you look at representations of queerness within horror films, what you see in, say, the 1930s differs radically from what we're seeing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a slow change in trajectory, and so I thought maybe we would talk about what each grouping of decades has to offer a queer horror fan. So in the 1930s and 1940s, that's when you're dealing primarily with coded monsters.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you who don't know, coding is just basically something that came out of Hays Code, which laid out a bunch of things you couldn't show on film. And one of them was homosexuality. And so what emerged were really these narratives and films where it operated on two levels. There was the story that the quote-unquote dominant culture, heteronormative, would read the story as. And then there were also these little inklings underneath, these coded moments that would read very differently for a queer audience. And so some of those movies that you see that happen in is The Old Dark House from 1932, Dracula's Daughter from 1936. Oh my God, I love that movie. Rebecca, 1940, and Cat People from 1942.
I hate vampire films, but I love Dracula's Daughter.
Because it's so much more than a vampire movie,
I mean,
she's
a hella woman. Like, I want to hang out with her.
I mean, I'm pretty sure I wrote about Dracula's Daughter, and I'm pretty sure I wrote about Cat People. Sorry, guys. It gets to a point where you start to forget what you wrote about.
It's the old age.
Yeah, it really is. But what I think is so interesting about, like, 1930s and 40s queer characters is that they definitely occupy, for the most part, a more aggressive stance. So like in Rebecca, you have Mrs. Danvers, mm-hmm. who is super creepy. I mean, you have her going into bedrooms and smelling the underwear of her deceased mistress. And she just comes across as like, this is not a lady that I want to be in a room left alone with.
That's not normal?
not on the whole, no.
Oh.
Oh, boy.
This is why Dawn's not here. She keeps me in line, guys.
She really does.
You're in for something.
Oh, God. But Dracula's daughter, I think, is one of the more interesting exceptions because Countess Seleska, she's really struggling with something.
Yeah.
And you see her struggling with these quote-unquote impure impulses. And her relationship is set against her manservant, Sandor, who is the prototypical, like, sissy character. And I'm saying sissy in quotation marks. It's an archetype. And you have those two sort of battling it out. And then in Cat People, you have Irina, who, again, is a very sympathetic character and, again, is, like, struggling against this impulse that is impure and that she doesn't want, but she's powerless against because it's just something innate to who she is. I think for a lot of queer horror viewers, especially younger ones, they tend to reject these films because it does position queerness as a disease of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what you think that has to offer audiences now, if anything.
See, when I think about those films, specifically those films, and then that time period too, what always stood out more to me was the fact that these coded kind of characters were always foreign. So I think that that's important. And that kind of came up in our discussion about But I'm a Cheerleader too, about like, oh, well, I'm French. That's my root.
Mm.
So it was very foreign. And they were often quite higher class. So my head kind of goes to, you know, what's going on with that. And then they have some gender role stuff that, but so that's a problem that they have over there. That's not something. And it's coming here and it's infringing on our country. Because again, horror at that time was very much us, them.
Definitely.
You know, foreign threats. You had all kinds of different, you know.
Still is in a way.
Well, yeah. Yeah. So I think that that's where my head went with that. I don't know if I quite thought about it the other way. What do you think about it?
For me, I like to introduce these films to younger students, especially because I think it does speak to a very particular time in American culture. So not only are these films coded, there are moments that are specifically for you as a queer viewer. But I think it's important for people to know their history. And I feel like that's something, as history gets taken out of the classroom, and let's face it, queer history, even if it was rarely in the classroom, it still wasn't always told from a queer perspective. And I feel like these films offer an opportunity to understand what life was like when queerness was defined as an actual medical illness, like something that you could be cured from. And seeing that struggle play out on film, I think, is a way to maybe make that conversation a little bit more accessible to people. So I do appreciate those films, whereas I have had some students push back and say, you know, I don't want to see these type of representations. I don't want, you know, to think that who I am is an illness or something that shouldn't be viewed as normal. And
it's a moment in time.
It is a moment in time. But I think for especially younger audiences now, that there is a disconnect there.
Yeah.
That I'm noticing more and more because I'm getting older. So
yeah.
I'm definitely noticing it more and more. But I think in terms of queer horror specifically, that is something that these representations have to offer people.
And I think that that's something that's important is just the idea that people had to create spaces. I was so blessed that I was able to come to a university like Lehigh, and I got to study with Alexander Doty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had great different types of histories and books presented to me that really drove home the importance of just creating a space.
Yes.
And I think that that is something that people forget how important that was. And watching these films gives you a clearer sense of just the baby steps that sometimes you had to make.
It's interesting, too, because from the 30s and 40s, we move, obviously, into the 1950s, where monsters start to invade suburbia, and they take on a very particular sci-fi bend,
yeah,
right?
Atomic
so,
threats.
Yeah, absolutely. My favorite of these is probably I Was a Teenage Werewolf from 1957, and you're dealing with Tony and his quote-unquote beastly urges, and it's so readily apparent to me that this is a queer movie. But I like the monster element because I like the fact that if you're going to position queerness as something that's an illness, I want to see how that manifests itself. And I feel like once it manifests itself as a monster,
yeah,
it's easier to identify with
it. And it's more overt, I think, with a werewolf than a vampire.
And this also brings in the wonderful book Monsters in the Closet by Benshoff, which I continually reference. And really, honestly, even to like non-academic people who are listening to the podcast, people who just like horror films, this is one of those books that I would really recommend recommend because it does track the trajectory of queerness in horror films. And it really talks about how sort of the science fiction monster sort of created a space for empathy. Because when we see monsters like, you know, the werewolf or Dracula or, you know, Creature from the Black Lagoon, who's my favorite, there is a built-in empathy because you're literally seeing like the physical manifestation of difference. And everybody knows how it feels to be different in some respect.
Frankenstein's monster.
So I like that that's what the 1950s are doing. But I know your research is in like suburbia and monsters, and you're doing some really cool stuff with that. Do you see any impact that these queer representations have on like how people conceive of suburbia?
So first I have to go back because my brain is stuck. And when my brain is stuck,
I know
I can't
how
move
this
forward.
Is.
Can you say werewolf for me again?
Werewolf?
Yeah, I feel like there's no L in that word. It's like a werewolf.
You hate on my people so much.
And I'm just checking. And I also feel like there's mosquitoes in here. So if you see a mosquito on me or if I'm just flapping about, please.
There are
just,
definite mosquitoes.
There's something going on in here. Either that or I've become infested. I don't know. Is this stuff catchy? Am I going to get the queer gene? Is something going to happen to me in here because we're talking about it?
I have really bad news for you. You have the queer gene.
Oh, my God. Do I at least get a toaster oven for this? All right. So the larger question, do I see an impact of the queerness in suburbia?
Yeah.
Was that the broader question?
Yeah. Like, do you see an actual argument to be made that, like, the construction of these monsters allow the threat, quote unquote, of homosexuality to infiltrate suburbia? Because I've heard those arguments that that's one thing the monsters allow.
I never really thought about it. That's a really good question.
It is a good question.
I don't know, because again, you know, I don't always prefer the older horror.
I stand alone.
So it hasn't been as pronounced, I don't think, in that kind of way. But yeah, you're probably right. Now I'm going to have to review some things. And think about this.
I'm sorry.
You always come up with these really important and thoughtful questions, and then I'm just kind of like, oh my God, I don't know.
Well, that's okay, because I don't know either. That's why I asked
okay.
you.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm just trying to figure out why there's these differences in how we're seeing queerness play out on the screen and like sort of what maybe were some of the things culturally happening at that time. Because I feel like, you know, obviously you have the Cold War at that point. And so there was that fear of contamination. And so I wonder if that that concept of contamination, we know it infiltrated into suburbia. And I wonder if queerness got associated with that contamination. I don't know.
Yeah,
but I
don't
think
know,
that that's
because,
something
I mean,
worth thinking about.
Gender roles and sexuality was super important at that time period.
Right.
Because the way that other countries would view our country was largely kind of based on some of that stuff. So you think about the kitchen debates and you think about how there was arguments that, well, our women are better, they cook better, and they look greater in their, they look better in their aprons, and these Russian women are just big and brutish. And so I guess it would kind of make sense that it's kind of filtering in then. But what it means, I don't know.
There's a think piece for someone.
Take it
and run with it.
And write it for Horror Homeroom.
That's
I'm just
right.
saying. We're always looking for people even smarter than us. Not hard.
No. No, it's really not. Oh, my God. So that brings us to, obviously, the 1960s and the 1970s. So don't worry. We're getting closer to the horror that you like. Because I know I nerd out on the earlier stuff.
That's okay. That's what makes us wonderful. We compliment each other.
There you go. We'll go with that. So the 60s and 70s, what do you see? You see return away from the monster, like the overt monster, and you see a return to like the human form.
Right.
I think it's fair to say. And what's always been interesting to me about the 60s and 70s is that you see a definitive shift of how those queer characters, they go from being sympathetic because they're dealing with this like shameful secret to being flat out predatory.
Yeah.
And you especially see that with lesbians. And so you have things like Orgy of the Dead from 1965. You have, I don't know, Vampire Lovers from 1970, The Daughters of Darkness, 1971, and even the Rocky Horror Picture Show from 1975. There's this really discernible predatory vibe that comes from these characters. Like a real significant threat that's intentional to sort of the heterosexual characters or the heteronormative couplings within all of these movies. And it's interesting to me that, you know, it's the 60s and 70s. This is when you're seeing like the dawn of the new queer rights movement. You
free
got
love,
Stonewall,
man.
You got free love. It doesn't seem to jive with what's happening culturally.
I think we just made men nervous because they know we do it better. Boom, I got your girlfriend. No, I don't know. I don't know why that would start to show up then as something so threatening and so predatory.
But it kind of goes into the argument that ultimately horror is conservative.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point.
Yeah, which I've always pushed back on. But no, when I was like... thinking about this, I was like, yeah, because it is always a return to quote unquote normalcy. And really what that right looks like in. Is very specific. So it's a little disappointing when you're looking at like queer horror and you're like, oh, the 60s and 70s. I mean, there's still transcendence. I mean, obviously, we did a full podcast on the Rocky Horror Picture Show and our equipment at the time was crap. So yeah. That's always bothered me. But I think the content of that really supports about why, even though there is something predatory about Frankenfooter, mm-hmm. it's secondary. Because for queer audiences, that's like very celebratory. Like, hey, we're on screen. We're fabulous. We got a banging soundtrack behind us. Yeah. And you know what I mean? Like
we're time warp and into history.
Yeah, we're coming into our own and we're going to do it on our terms.
Yeah.
But I think for heterosexual audiences or people who first saw that, they were like, nah, man. Or conservative audiences, yeah. I should say, because honestly, the people who were repeatedly going were a large swath of people. I mean, all ages, all races, all genders, all sexualities.
I love the fact that it's 2019 and in my primary job, you know, I'm a trainer, so I train all kinds of different things. And one of the things that I have to teach is physical restraints. So people have to contort themselves into all kinds of different positions that don't always feel natural to them.
Yeah.
And over again for the last couple months, just recently, almost every single class when I'm teaching how to do these procedures, somebody in the classroom goes, I feel like I'm in Rocky Horror Picture Show doing the time warp.
Get out of here.
Yeah. And it's fantastic. People different ages, too. Mostly women. And then, of course, we all break out into the time warp and we start, you know, pelvic thrusting.
As one does.
Yeah.
I wonder if that coincides with I'm seeing more and more midnight shows.
Yeah.
Of it. So I wonder if it's finding a new audience again. That's pretty interesting, though.
Yeah, it just started happening.
I like that that's still a popular culture reference that I don't have to give up yet in my advanced age.
Then it throws me off my game, though, while I'm training, because then I start geeking out on Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Oh, that soundtrack.
And completely forget about talking about all the other important things that I'm supposed to be doing.
Forget about it.
I know.
You're doing the important work of God.
I am.
So from the 60s and 70s, we lead, sadly, into the 1980s, which I know is your preferred decade.
Who says sadly?
Well, sadly in that for queer horror films, I mean, you're seeing Reagan's conservatism. You're seeing definitive shock value. You're seeing AIDS taken on, maybe mm-hmm. not in the best way. And you're definitely, I think, seeing a return to like the monstrous queer.
Yeah.
But through Contagion in a way, which ties into what was happening with AIDS at the time. But I have to go to Cruising from 1980 with, oh, who is it? Al Pacino. And whoo, that's something. And it's interesting talking to queer audiences on that one, because in my experience, it's always been pretty evenly divided. You have some people who are like, yo, that's what the queer clubs with BDSM were like mm-hmm. in the late 70s, New York City. Like, that's what it is. And then you have other people who say, you know, it's just shock value. It's marginalizing. It presents a community in a very negative, specific way that really doesn't encapsulate the full experience. And so it's always interesting to hear discussion on that movie. That might actually be something that when Dawn comes back that we should revisit, because I would be curious to hear your guys' perspectives on it. But in terms of where we're at with queer horror, it's not a good time. Having said that, we also lead into Sleepaway Camp from 1983. Mm-hmm. And the whole shock of that is predicated on, I don't want to spoil it, but I feel like 1983. I mean, when you find out that a character that you thought you knew about, in a particular way is actually different. Not how you viewed this particular character. And the way that that revelation is used so specifically for shock value is true. I mean, there are a lot of problems with it. I mean, there have been a lot of great think pieces about why you can still enjoy this movie as a queer spectator.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And I do. I like Sleepaway Camp. Yeah. But it's still, I think, is important to talk about why that moment for people could really
well, it's positioned as
harmful.
Here's the reemergence of the monster.
Yes.
The monstrous monster. It's almost as if, you know, Jason is lurching back up from the water onto the canoe. I mean, it's kind of that.
Yeah.
That's how I think it was kind of visually presented.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, like real talk, like the T in LBGT has been silenced more often than not. And so I think the fact that that comes into play in this film. I definitely understand why it gives people pause. We also then move into Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, Freddy's Revenge, 1985. And we get Jesse as the final boy. And that film, there is no way anybody can watch that film and not say that's homoerotic. Again, it is that monstrous queer. And you also get that in Hellraiser in 1987 as well.
Oh, I love those films.
They're great movies.
They really are.
They're great movies. But I think it is possible to enjoy a movie and still be like, okay, that's a problem. And I understand why that would turn some people off. It doesn't turn me off because...
Pinhead's probably one of my favorite movie monsters.
How do you feel as like a queer spectator? Do you feel obligated to be outraged?
No, you're ridiculous. Get out of here.
I mean, that is a conversation that's happening,
though. I don't represent my people. Trust me, y'all don't want me representing any of you for any group. Trust me. I'm like Groucho Marx. I don't want to be a part of any club that wants to have me in it, you know?
Yeah.
Y'all don't want to be a part of any group that wants me in it. I watch my films to have a good time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't go to films looking for my meaning. I mean, sure, is it great to see some stuff that, you know, represents me? Yeah, absolutely. But at the end of the day, in a horror movie, if I was scared, it's a win.
So for queer horror films, it's more important for you that it first and foremost be a horror film.
Yeah,
as opposed to a queer, right?
Otherwise, I'm not watching it, which is why I don't watch or love a lot of overtly queer horror films. Like, it's just not I don't have to have a strong female in my films to enjoy it either.
Right.
I just want to be scared.
You just want to be
scared. I don't care if my ghost is a guy, a girl, lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans. Like, I want my ghost to scare me.
Well, we're going to revisit that in just a minute
because we're
getting back into, so that brings us to the 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
And the 1990s totally fascinate me for queer horror because on one hand, you have new queer cinema happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we just did a podcast on Psycho Beach Party, which is 2000, but I'm a cheerleader.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of radical things happening for queer cinema in the 90s. And for whatever reason, it didn't seem to translate into horror specifically. In fact, it was almost the opposite. So you have things like Silence of the Lambs from 1991 or Heavenly Creatures from 1994.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost feels like queer horror during the 90s was deliberately pushing back against the strides the queer cinema was making. So especially with Silence of the Lambs. And I am as guilty as the next person as quoting, "It rubs the lotion on its skin."
Oh, my gosh.
You know what I mean? Like, you know.
I dance in front of my mirror just like that.
I mean, that was probably more information than I needed, but we'll just leave that out there into the podcast sphere. That is a terribly problematic character. I get that. But I still really like that movie.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And
it's a phenomenal movie.
As a queer audience member, when I saw that movie in the theater probably 8 times. I was obsessed with it, especially Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah.
And yes, I knew I was a queer spectator. It didn't take away from it. Even though I was like, it's always got to be the gay guy. Always got to be the gay guy. Why does that have to equate to monster? But I was still able to enjoy the film in and of itself. I was a little bit more problematized by Heavenly Creatures, which I love that movie. And I think probably because it's based on a true life story and it's more of an ethereal movie. I think the fact that at its center you have two female characters who are clearly, if they're not involved in a lesbian relationship, there are definitive lesbian undertones and overtones to that relationship. I've gone back and forth trying to figure out, well, why in the 90s did horror film really, really resist the strides being made? I don't know.
Because horror wasn't even that good in the 90s.
Oh, shots fired. I mean, I wouldn't agree with that. But see, we need Dawn here for this because she'd be like, wait a minute.
No.
So I think that's a question that, you know, is worth for people to think about. We come into the 2000s, and I think in the 2000s, now you're starting to see the evolution of queer horror films. So you have Seed of Chucky with Glenn and Glenda and really just going all in on tackling gender non-binary issues. And you have Jennifer's Body where you have, I guess, in a way, a monster queer, but really sort of being deconstructed in what I would see as a positive step forward. And that would, of course, then bring us into like the 2010s and on where it's like, pride. And this is where I think it becomes problematic, because a lot of these movies that are like, these are good representations, like this is what we deserve, I don't know that they're the best movies.
No, I agree.
So I love The Babadook. 2015.
Yeah.
I'm glad we claimed that one.
I stand
by that movie. But then it also brings us to something like What Keeps You Alive from 2018. And for those of you who haven't seen it, I did not care for the movie. I know other people did. At the center is a lesbian relationship. And you have both the monster queer, and then you also have the sympathetic queer. So you have both existing in the same film. So in that respect, I guess it's an evolution. I just didn't think it was a very good movie.
Yeah.
And I guess my question is, does it count as an evolution if it's not a good movie? It's
yeah,
a tough one.
I think it's different. You're never going to make everybody happy, period.
Especially us.
No, definitely not. But think about it. So like, okay, if you yourself could have your own representation in a horror film, you got to be in the horror film.
Right.
Do you want to be the killer? Do you want to be the final girl? Do you want to be a side character? You want to be a side piece, don't you?
Hell no. I want to be the final girl. Are you kidding me?
See, I want to be the killer.
This does not surprise me in the
slightest. No, I want to be the killer.
No, I want to be the final girl.
Like, I don't think that there's a problem with being...
Well, it depends on what type of killer. I mean, are we talking about someone like Hannibal Lecter, who's, like, got all the tools of the trade? Yeah, he's got all the tools of the trade.
No.
Are you talking about some, like, nameless, voiceless monster like Jason that just, like, prances about in the woods?
No, like, I would love a pinhead, because he's kind of, like, a perfect combination of, like, your Hannibal Lecter, who's super smart. Well-spoken. I mean, he could take you in a verbal battle anytime.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's very powerful. He's very commanding. But at the same time, he's a movie monster.
Mm.
I love my movie monsters. I love horror films with just big, bad monsters with weapons. So, yeah, I think that you'll never make people happy, like everybody happy, because I want to be the bad guy. I'm okay with it. Some people might call me predatory. Some people might call me this. They might call me that. I want to be the slasher.
It's interesting.
I don't get to do that in my everyday life.
I would hope not.
No. I don't want to do that in my everyday life.
That's
but
a good clarification.
If I want to be in the movie, I want to be the star.
And you don't think see, that's an interesting question. So you think the monster is the star and not the person who survives the monster.
Yeah, the final girl doesn't scare me. That's not what makes it horror.
I mean, the trajectory of horror would be on your side with this. Like, if you look at merchandise, it's always the killer. You very rarely get a significant or on par amount of merchandise that correlates to the final girl.
I mean, yeah, I love my survivors. They're fine and good. But yeah, when it comes down to merchandise, I'm not buying theirs.
No. Oh, you're sitting there right now with the Jason ring, which is badass as hell. I love that so much.
Yeah. I want to be the star.
So where do you think queer horror is going? Do you have any ideas?
I don't know. Does it have to be something overtly queer horror? Like, I don't know. I guess it depends on what your goal is, your end goal is. Like,
well, I guess I'm just interested in it from the perspective of if horror films reflect what's happening culturally and we're in such a bizarre-ass political and social time with regard to the current administration and the current administration's stance on LGBTQ+ issues. What are queer horror films going to look like? How are they going to push back on that? Or are they? Or are they going to reflect what's happening?
And then reel it back in.
Yeah, and return back to sort of the coded monster of the 30s and 40s, or perhaps worse, the overt monster of maybe like the 50s, 60s.
No, I don't think that it's going to go to coded. I do think it'll always be a conservative genre because I think that everybody loves their happy endings, you know.
And I suppose, too, it's dependent upon whether we're talking about mainstream horror versus independent horror.
I'm talking mainstream.
Yeah.
That's kind of just more.
Yeah.
I think that we're just going to, we've got the corner market on camp and horror comedy, and I'm happy with that.
Boy, that's the truth.
Yeah.
That is the truth.
That's the best part of the whole genre, in my opinion, so.
So if you had to name one queer horror film.
I was going to ask you the same
that's
thing.
That's your favorite.
I don't
know. See, we're on a wave like, you don't have one that's a favorite.
No, because I guess I never really viewed my horror through the lens of sexuality. I just went to get scared.
Right.
And first and foremost, before thinking about horror, I just wanted to get scared.
Well, what about your favorite horror film with a queer character who's central?
God, I don't even know.
See, for me, it's Rocky Horror Picture Show. It has to be. Like, for me, that's the one I would recommend.
I mean, I love that film.
Shove.
Yeah. But I've never really thought about it.
See, we're different on that. I very much see that as a queer film, but you don't.
I don't know. I'm just saying in general, I've never really thought about it. Like, I've never thought about.
Am I hurting your head?
A little bit. I don't know.
My work here is done.
Because I was sitting here thinking about it. I was like, I don't even know. So first, y'all know I couldn't come up with a top 10 of queer horror films.
I couldn't either.
There's no way. Like, I'd have to pull horror films that had queer characters.
Mm-hmm.
But that even requires too much thought for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of makes sense because I think you're probably a little bit more about the experience.
Yeah.
And so to really dissect it in that way probably takes away from the experience, maybe.
Yeah, and I never really thought about it.
Yeah.
Sexuality wasn't always at the forefront of what's important to me.
Right, right.
I don't know. I'd rather be identified for being kind, funny, outgoing. So even things like, you know, gender and class and sexuality weren't as important to me.
I would say that was very much true for me when I was younger, but as I've gotten older, I definitely do think representation is so important and that there are actual examples of people for kids to see.
It is.
And so I have changed my thinking on that because I used to be very much along the same line of thinking as you. But for me, that has changed a little bit. And of course, there's no right or wrong to it. It's
no.
Just, you know, how you identify it, how you feel comfortable.
Representations are important. Everybody's got to be able to see themselves somewhere.
Right. But I'm that person now who's demanding, I want to see some representation in syllabi. I want to see some representation in the classroom. I want in history. And you
there,
know what I mean?
Agree with you. There, yeah. I agree with you. When it just comes to viewing things, I think sometimes you just got to carve your own path.
Yeah.
And you
got to find
your own whole, your own like spaces, and you got to see what you want to see.
And what's of use to you and value. Absolutely. And that is one of the benefits of horror, I would say.
Yeah.
Is that it does create all those different types of spaces. But the second thing we wanted to do in today's podcast, believe it or not, is to get into our top 10 favorite non-horror.
Yes.
Queer films. And... Oh, this
man.
Was a tough list for me to do. And I am so curious to see how much overlap I have so many.
Yeah, that was where I had a
lot of time. I have
time.
So many.
Like, I didn't even have to think. I just sat down on my couch and I just rattled off, like, boom, 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 boom.
Yep.
And I came up with, like, 16.
Oh, God.
And then, of course, I sat here feverishly trying to whittle it down. I mean, I'll never make it to 10 because it's just not going to happen and I don't want to. But, yeah, these are good movies.
Oh, these are such good movies. And I had to define it for myself as important to me.
Yeah.
Queer movies, because there's just too many good ones. And there really are. There
and
are a
good
lot.
Good movies.
Yes,
too.
Yes. Excellent movies. So, do you want to kick things off?
I can. So, I did a terrible list because I just kind of went stream of consciousness and just started writing down movies that just came to the forefront of my brain.
But you did rank them.
No. Get out of here.
One day you're going to surprise me.
No, but I can tell you my hands down favorite.
Oh, good.
Oh,
okay.
That's easy. And I just stream of consciousness. I didn't write down years, I didn't write names of characters.
I just
went full feeling into this and closed the laptop and then called you up and was like, oh my God,
God.
I got mine, you know. So these two are kind of tangled into each other. They're similar films. They kind of evoked the same kind of things for me. I have Gia.
Okay.
And I have High Art.
I knew High Art would be on yours.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, if I'm going to go for a drama, I want some recklessness in there.
Mm-hmm.
I want some bad choices in there. And I do think that, again, if people are struggling with demons, sometimes substances come into play.
Absolutely.
So I think that it was important to talk about, too. And
mm-hmm.
Gia, of course, is based on a real person.
Yeah.
High Art is just more of a film, but they deal with similar characters that go through their own substance abuse.
They do pair nicely.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, see, I'm good at pairing.
I'm impressed.
I am.
All right.
Next, I'm going to go Lost and Delirious.
Yes.
Because I love some of the stuff that happens towards the end. Sometimes I love, this is so, it's almost so Shakespearean,
mm-hmm.
this film. It's got its comedy, it's got its tragedy, it's got its drama.
It has fencing.
Yeah, it does have fencing in an all-girls boarding school.
Of course.
Because, again, that's everybody's route, you know.
Naturally.
So Lost and Delirious was up there. You have what's her name? Piper Perabo in that one,
yes,
too?
Yes, yes.
Whom also shows up in another one of my films.
It has Misha Barton as well.
And it's not Coyote Ugly, although I do love Coyote Ugly.
Don't
speak against
okay.
it. Blasphemy. I will get up and dance on this table right now.
Please don't do that.
I would do that. But she's also in Imagine Me and You.
Okay. Is that on your list?
Love that movie. Yes.
Really?
Yes. I hate rom-coms.
You don't, though.
But I love Imagine Me and You.
You want to say you hate rom-coms?
No.
But I think you are a secret Lifetime movie rom-com watcher.
I think the last Lifetime movie I watched was the one where Nancy McKeon gets her head stomped on. Yeah, that's a horrific film. I never want to see it again.
And I love Nancy McKeon. What you were talking about. That memory is so etched in my head.
Yeah, it was horrific.
It is horrific, yeah.
It was absolutely, oh my God. But Nancy McKeon was in it, which I love her. Joe Polnicek, Facts of Life, also in the movie. Poison Ivy with Michael J.
Another lesbian icon. Even though she's not.
Totally. Yeah. Agreed. I'll give you that one. So Imagine Me and You is on there. All right.
Well, wait a minute. We have to dissect Imagine Me and You a little bit because to me, that is very much a traditional rom-com movie. So what is it about that movie in particular that makes you willing to overlook its genre? Because this is not a Gwen movie at all.
You know, I love her love interest. What's her name? I can't remember her name. It's never going to come to me. I might have to Google it.
I don't care for that movie, so.
You don't? I actually do own it.
Ooh.
Yeah. I would Google it, but it's going to make lots of clicking noises, and that's going to come up in the audio. But I really like her love interest in that film. She's such a – I feel like she's just a good representation in my head of somebody that's smart, and she's funny, and she knows what she wants, and she'll go after it. And I just love Piper Perabo, too, in it. She starts running across the hoods of cars.
She is super likable.
Yes!
Yeah,
I don't know. Good soundtrack. Yeah, I don't know. I don't really have an excuse for it. I just really, really love it. So moving down my list, the movie April's Shower. Okay. I love that film. So the general premise is you have these two women. They were formerly lovers. They're now kind of like best friends, which tends to kind of happen in some of these couplings. You stay friends. Well, the ex-girlfriend end up being... She's throwing the bridal shower for her ex, who is now going to get married to a man. And all hilarity ensues. You have some gender-bending things that happen in there. You have some passive-aggressive manifestations that come up. And it's a good movie. I like that one. I always like when there's a little bit of dysfunction in my films. Like, I love dark humor. I love dysfunctional families. I love some of these, like, holy shit, dinner party kind of movies.
Yeah. So, but you know what that is?
No, it's stop
it. It's a rom-com.
Oh, stop it.
It is.
Oh, ooh, stop
you
it.
You are a closet rom-com watcher. It is time the
stop
world
it.
Knows.
No. I'm going to throw Chasing Amy on there. I know there's going to be haters out there about the film Chasing Amy.
We're going to revisit that one on my list.
Because I, you know what, first of all, I love the Mallrats film. Mm-hmm. I did like Clerks, not as much.
Oh, I love Clerks.
Yeah, no.
Oh, I love Clerks. I do not like
my
Clerks.
My brother, his favorite is Clerks, too.
Oh, I love it.
I love Chasing Amy. I love that it came out around a time period, too, that there's whole that just this idea about bisexuality.
Yes.
I think she's a beautiful representation. I don't necessarily love how it ends. But it was a funny film. Like, and you just, I don't know, I enjoyed it.
Also a rom-com.
Oh, geez, I can't. Back to my list. But I'm a Cheerleader, of course. One of my favorite films of all time. Not just of this type of film. Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Ooh. I love Priscilla.
I was actually surprised
desert.
That I came up with so many lesbian films because I was telling you on the phone, too, that I always identified with the gay guys. Mm-hmm. I hung out with the gay guys. I clubbed with the gay guys. I danced with the gay guys. I enjoyed my humor and my time. My friends were more the guys.
Right.
The films are actually really, really funny, too. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, though, I broke it down to what films did I buy and keep at home.
Yeah.
And the films that I bought and kept at home did happen to be a lot of these lesbian films, except for Priscilla. I love Priscilla. Great soundtrack.
Oh, amazing
great road
soundtrack.
Story. You know, trouble in my family. It's a good film.
Such empathetic characters. I love that. The only reason I didn't put that on my list is because I knew for sure you would have it.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
I love that movie.
Because I let that one slip when I was all excited about my list. And then I've got... So I have the movie Rent on here. Because, no, you did not just make a gagging face.
I surely
Are you serious?
Did. I don't like Rent.
Are you serious?
I have no soul. I had somebody tell me that because I don't like Rent.
I mean, I love the play. I love the film.
I like some of the music.
I think they supplement each other. The music is really good. And not every single character is gay, lesbian, bisexual, whatever. But it deals with the AIDS crisis. And it deals with people of different genders and sexualities. And
And forging your own family.
Yes.
Yeah,
and
that's
I think
important.
That was more important, too.
Yeah.
Is just... Creating your family,
that.
Which is also something that you see, and I'll keep mentioning, in that television show Pose.
Oh, yeah.
because they...
Which I only watched on your recommendation, and I...
Unbelievable.
Marathon through that first season.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Those characters, amazing.
It's so, so good.
So my last few ones, I feel like I'm, well, we all know I have like 15 choices. So
bring them all. I want to hear them all because
I have
just wait.
Eulogy, which is not a gay film. I had just spoken to you about this
film.
Eulogy is definitely in the top three films I've ever seen in my life.
Really?
Yes. Hands down. Because again, it deals with dysfunctional family.
Yeah.
Dark comedy. And it has one of the best kind of like coming out reveals in a film ever. So whereas it's not a primary theme of the film,
mm-hmm.
when this character comes out or is like thrust out and then starts, pardon my friends, like song fucking her girlfriend in front of her family at what's supposed to be becoming a funeral. Like it's amazing on so many levels.
Ooh.
It's got some star-studded cast. If you haven't seen Eulogy, you need to see Eulogy. Over any film that I ever recommend in my life, you have to see Eulogy.
Okay, so I would take that seriously.
It's a good... If you like dark comedy, then it's good. If you liked things kind of in the vein of Running with Scissors, Little Miss Sunshine...
Oh, there you go.
Even, you know, Juno, those types of films, you'll appreciate this one.
Okay.
Death at a Funeral, that's another good one.
Death at a Funeral, I
yeah.
like Death at a Funeral.
If you like Death at a Funeral, you'll like Eulogy. So then I'm going to come to my number one film, which also would be in my top three films probably
of all
time. I was
just going to say, it's not Eulogy?
No. My number one film, Debs.
Oh.
Which, yes, I know is a rom-com. Is a rom-com.
Get out. Top three all time.
So it also probably has my favorite scene ever in any film, which is when Lucy Diamond is trying to win her girlfriend back. So she's trying to, you know, fix her evil ways and
evil
give
ways.
Back everything that she's ever stolen and fix all these, you know, mend all these fences. And they use the Erasure song. Respect, a little respect.
I love Erasure.
And when that song comes on and they start lip syncing to it,
that's
it is my
moment.
Everything.
It's a good moment.
That is my happy place. When I'm having a bad day, I Google, I YouTube that scene.
Okay.
I love it. I absolutely love it.
I can't really push back on any of those.
No.
I mean, the...
And again, it's super campy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ridiculous. Like, it's amazing.
I like how your sensibility really comes across in the movies that you picked. Because, no, they all of those make sense. Knowing you, all of those make total sense to me.
Oh, that's just good movies.
I just love the fact that rom-coms feature so
Isn't it
prominently.
Crazy?
It's just amazing to me.
And I would easily take these over a lot of the queer horror films. Any queer horror film. Any queer horror film. Any queer character in a horror film. I would take the bulk of these films. And a special shout out to Showgirls.
Showgirls.
Because
Oh my God.
I love Gina Gershon. That is like
I'm surprised Bound wasn't on your list,
no,
actually.
No. I didn't enjoy that one that much.
Okay.
Showgirls was everything. It was glittery.
Because it's campy.
It was glitzy.
Yeah.
You have Jessie,
I like
you have
Showgirls.
Jessie
I don't...
Spano in it from Saved by the Bell.
She's so excited.
And Gina Gershon is unbelievably attractive to me. I don't ever get movie crushes.
Yeah.
Ever get movie crushes. Because
I think
it's stupid and you know, unrealistic.
Yeah.
But I think she is absolutely mind-blowing.
Well, there you
I
have
know.
It. Gina, hit her up. That's fascinating to me. Like, just listening to you talk about all these movies that are so decidedly campy. This is very strange to me because I'm looking at my list now and I love campy movies. And yet, I do. Like, that's if you look at my very minimal DVD collection, that's what it largely is. That is not reflected on my list. But when I thought about, like, the important movies to me that were queer movies, this is what I came up with. But I do have some caveats because
yes, I'm okay with caveats.
I had literally 50 movies when I just did Stream of Consciousness, just writing out all the movies that I love. So I did not include coded movies. Okay. So I left off Bride of Frankenstein, Dracula's Daughter, Bringing Up Baby, and Ben-Hur. So those are four movies that I really do enjoy where the queerness is coded. So I said, okay, no coded queerness. It has to be overt. Okay, so it took those great movies out of the running. It also took out movies where the film adaptations removed the queerness from the source material. So Fried Green Tomatoes, written by Fanny Flagg, is one of my all-time favorite movies.
But they stripped
the queerness of that novel out of that movie. It's implied heavily, but you don't actually see it. And that was a problem for me. So I was like, I can't have that on my list. Oh, we have to do one on that movie because I adore that movie.
Yo, that's a ride or die friend, man.
Yeah, you're not kidding. You are not kidding.
That's a good representation of the South, man. I told you I'm scared of Southerners because the representations aren't very great. I mean,
you just haven't seen enough Southern film, but we're going to educate you and it's going to be okay. But that's one. But that's one.
Yeah.
Another movie that took away the source material queerness is Cat on a Hot Tin Roof by Tennessee Williams. Mm-hmm. I love that movie, but they really strip it down to the bare bones. And again, it's suggested, but I felt like for this list, it had to be overt. And I also left out films that I really, really love that have great, really great queer characters, but it's not necessarily what I would define as a queer film. So that takes away Silkwood, which I love that movie, Cher, but I don't feel like that's a queer movie. It just has a really great queer character. And it took away The Maltese Falcon for me as well. So all of those are movies I definitely recommend people check out, but they're not on my top 10 list. But I had to give him a shout out.
I'm glad
that's
you
who
did.
Who I am.
I'm glad you did because good. Those are some really good films that kind of, I was like, oh yeah.
Yeah. So, what did make it to my list? I did rank them because, again, y'all know me.
You're a librarian.
Yeah, I can't help it. Number 10 is Beginners from 2010. It is a romantic comedy. So, I'm going to give a shout out for Gwen on that one. And honestly, unlike Gwen, rom coms are not normally my bag at all.
But I feel like you would actually be more open to that life.
I mean,
because we talked about kind of queer as folk, L word, and like, I'm Brian Kenny. Like,
oh yeah,
that's
for sure,
it, hands down. But I could see, like, I still see you as kind and good.
Well, not according to this list. No, but this is a rom-com. And what I love about this is Christopher Plummer plays a man whose wife of, I think it's like 50 years, passes away. And within the next couple of months, he comes out as gay. And it's about how he navigates coming out late in life and what impact that has on his relationship with his son. And it's such a sweet, loving movie. And yeah. It's just kind and compassionate to all of its characters. And I just love it. Number 9, I went with 1970. Surprising no one. I went with The Boys in the Band. And I know I'm going to hear about this one. It is not an unproblematic movie. I get that, okay? I know that they're remaking it. I'm sure they'll remove some of the more problematic elements. It was released, I think, within the year after, maybe 9 months after the Stonewall riots. But it's basically a group of men who are coming together for a dinner party to celebrate the birthday of one of the men. And it's a brutal, brutal movie in a lot of ways. But there's one scene in which Harold, who is the person who's having the birthday, that's the reason that I have it on the list. He basically talks about what it's like to be an unattractive queer man and what it means to be a gay man who is not beautiful in the traditional sense and what that means. And you can see that there's like a pain there that fuels what an asshole he is, because this character is truly an asshole, but he's angry and you kind of get why. And also a fun fact, it is the first American film to use the word cunt. So if
that's
that
amazing.
Doesn't sell, I thought that would sell it for you.
That would sell it for me.
Number 8 is...
underutilized word, man.
Number 8 is actually an HBO film from 2000, If These Walls Could Talk 2.
Of course you did.
This is my nod to schmaltzy. But again, I do have that gene. I can't help it. It's basically three separate stories told of lesbian couples from three different time periods. It's interesting to me, to, depending on where I am, like as I've gotten older, which story resonates more. The first set of stories talks about an elderly lesbian couple. One of them dies. It takes place in the 50s. So you see the impact of that. Like her home gets taken from her by the nephew who never even saw his aunt, but because she's not technically a family member, she can't inherit. And it's just so sad. And Vanessa Redgrave and Marion Seldes are, they will make you cry. And then it goes into 1972 and it's Michelle Williams and it's Chloe Sevigny. And to me, when they go onto the dance floor and they dance to Bread's Baby I Want You, mm-hmm. it is...
Bread.
Oh, I love Bread. Listen, I will hear not a word against Bread. But that is such a perfectly placed soundtrack moment to me. Number 7 is actually a tie. And interestingly, there are the two movies that you've mentioned.
Shut up.
I have Chasing Amy.
Yes.
Yes, I love Chasing Amy.
Me too.
And I think it's actually...
It's funny as hell.
A good depiction of bisexuality.
I do too.
If you think about it only in terms of Alyssa and her saying, you know, I don't have to choose. She gets pressure from her lesbian friends. And there's this great scene of them being like, well, you can't be with a man. You're a lesbian.
Oh, my God.
You
I've
have
had that
to
happen
pick
with
that.
My friends. It's so true.
But it's a better – you see that play out, especially in the 90s, like Go Fish.
Yeah.
You see that play out all the time.
Yeah.
But this is – I thought this movie did it. Best.
I agree.
And I get why it turns people off, but I still think it's a good movie.
I do too.
And I still stand by that one. Lost in Delirious,
yes!
2001. Again, this is Canadian. Like you mentioned, takes place at a boarding school.
I feel like you're having a little bit more sap than I have.
The ending is divisive.
I love the ending.
But the ending is divisive because
yeah.
people are like, oh, it's playing on that old trope.
No.
But how they get there is earned.
Yeah.
And I think it's a true story for some people.
I agree.
Not everyone survives adolescence. And, oh, it breaks my heart on absolutely every level. I have watched that so many times. I own that one.
I own that one too.
I never not get choked up at the end because her pain, Piper Perabo is amazing in that role.
And I think it also kind of just plays into sometimes too some of those early allies.
Yeah.
I can even remember for one of my closest friends growing up, one of her first allies ever in just navigating coming out because she was thrust out.
Yeah.
Because somebody saw her out in public like at a punk club.
Yeah.
And then just told the whole entire school and... She was just devastated. And it was a teacher. And that made her whole difference.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Oh, it's a good movie.
It is a good movie.
It's a good movie. Number 6 is from 1971, Sunday, Bloody Sunday.
Mm.
And I love this movie. It's a triangle of sorts between a bisexual artist who's played by Murray Head. And he's in a relationship with both a divorced woman who's played by Glenda Jackson and an older doctor who's gay, who's played by Peter Finch. And I like the fact that there's a real fluidity of sexuality happening. So you have bisexuality clearly defined. You have gayness clearly defined. And you even have heterosexuality and how those can all intermingle and weave and how just because you occupy one space does not mean, no matter what anyone will tell you, that you have to stay in that space. Where you want to be can be fluid. And it's just as authentic as for people who stay in fixed positions. So I love, love, love that movie. Number 5. Okay, this is another like tearjerker for me. It's from 1997. Mauvie and Rose. It's a Belgium film.
Yep, missed that one.
Oh my God. I don't know.
Are there subtitles?
Definitely subtitles.
I can't do it.
Definitely subtitles. And I remember watching this with another friend of mine who is gay, and he and I both just like sitting on the couch just sobbing because it's so
like a horrible idea.
Devastating. I know. What can I tell you? It was the 90s.
No, I trust it. You have good films on here.
But this is a family moves to their dream neighborhood and it's your typical family. Their youngest child, who everyone assumes to be a boy, expresses the wish to live as a girl. So it's that first sort of movie that really kind of talks about transgender issues in a way. It's a very early discussion of it on film, but it's such a beautiful and sympathetic discussion. The community does not respond positively. The family deals with a lot of obstacles. The parents aren't just welcoming and loving and understanding. There's a lot of internal stuff that needs to be navigated that I think might feel a little bit reductive today. But when it came out, it just like broke all sorts of barriers. And the performance and the issue of like pronouns and gender expression that are happening right now,
yeah,
they weren't really happening in the 90s. And I think people forget that. And your heart just aches for this child. And to see this child have the power and the wherewithal to navigate this landscape and still try consistently to stay true to herself. It's just such a lovely movie. It's worth the subtitles, y'all.
You
I
just
swear
said it's
it
lovely.
Is. It's lovely. It's
Aww.
So beautiful because you want this child to be who she is.
See, you are kind and good.
Occasionally. Number four, I'm going to go not good. No, number four is And the Band Played On.
I forgot about that movie. That's a good one.
Yeah, from 1993. It's an HBO docudrama that traces the AIDS crisis. It starts in 1976 in the bathhouses and about how, you know, our government and other governments labeled it as sort of the gay plague, yeah, and what the trajectory was, the competition from between scientists and all the different things that went into allowing the AIDS crisis to continue unfettered for so long without our government ever saying this is a crisis, mm-hmm, instead of marginalizing and saying, oh, it's just the gay men's plague.
Yeah.
And I don't know. This was always a really powerful movie to me. And I think what makes it particularly powerful is at the very end, as the credits roll, they start to show celebrities or people of note who have HIV or, mm-hmm, had AIDS at that point. So you saw people like the tennis player.
Arthur Ashe. Yeah.
And you saw people like Miss Kitty, Gunsmoke's Amanda Blake, and people that you wouldn't quote unquote think,
yeah,
died of AIDS or were living with HIV. So I just find that really powerful.
It's a good film. I agree with you 100% on that one.
Yeah, that was an important one for me. Number three is All Over Me, 1997.
I have that on VHS.
It's about Claude and Ellen. They're best friends. They live in New York City. It really captures the flavor of 1990s New York City and also adolescent angst and what happens when you're queer and you might have feelings for your best friend who is not queer.
Dum, dum, dum.
Yeah. And I also like the fact that, you know, the best friend's a little manipulative about it.
Yeah.
And it really, it's kind of a really heady movie. I, mm-hmm, love that movie. I own that on DVD as,
yeah,
well.
Yeah, good call.
Number two is from 1982, and that is Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean.
Never, you ever seen?
No. Girl. Okay, no. So let me just lay this cast on you. Okay, so first we have Sandy Dennis, who, yes, she was in The Fox, and that's a super problematic lesbian movie, but I don't care. I love Sandy Dennis. She's fabulous. Cher, Karen Black, Sundy Bond, and Kathy Bates. I mean, do you need more?
No.
If you do, I'm going to give it to
Kathy
you.
Sharon Kathy Bates.
Right? It basically takes place inside like a Woolworths-esque department store in a small Texas town. And it's a coming together of an all-female fan club of James Dean. And they're reuniting. And oh, there's just a lot about performativity and gender and expectations and roles. All of that just weaved into this story. This will not be for everyone because this is like a straight up 70s movie where you're like, wait, what? I don't understand. What's happening? You just gotta go with it and just enjoy these characters. And it is so, so worth it. I love that movie. But very few people have watched it, I think.
Yeah.
Number one, 1999, Better Than Chocolate.
That was bumped off mine.
Was it?
Yeah, it was bumped off mine.
I don't know what it is about this movie.
It is a good movie, though.
I know there are better movies, though. But it captures something for me. And it's a Canadian movie. Maggie and Kim start a relationship. They attempt to hide when Maggie's mother comes to visit. And it's fabulous because Maggie's staying in a house of somebody who does, like, sex toy demonstrations. Mm-hmm. So you have, like, all the dildos all over the place. And it's just, I don't even know. It's just a happy movie to
me.
Even though there's angst, it gets at some like political things, but it's not, it doesn't feel like it's ever reaching. It's just like a nice, dare I say it, romantic comedy.
I'm shocked that that's your number one.
I'm shocked that it was my number one too. But when I thought about the movies that I just, a comforting, good movie that I enjoy, that brings me back to a particular time and place, that's the movie for me.
How do you feel about Absolutely Fabulous?
The fact that I went by Adina in college and my best friend went by Patsy should tell you everything you
That's
need
amazing.
To know. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if you guys don't watch Ab Fab, you have to.
Oh, my God.
It's an amazing show. I was just thinking about it.
It was a good time.
Yeah.
I love that
Not
show.
Not necessarily a homosexual show, but it's totally a queer show.
Yeah.
Even though it's just, yeah.
The sensibility is definitely queer.
I agree.
For sure.
I feel like we're taking that one.
We will not give it back.
And then also, lastly, L Word or Queer as Folk?
I would say Queer as Folk, the English version, then the L Word, then Queer as Folk, the U.S. version. That is my hierarchy.
Queer as Folk, American version.
As number one?
Yeah.
Really?
Yes. I was a club kid.
Ooh.
So I think I just identified with some of the debauchery that went on. Because it was real. I mean, it was, you know. I just was a party girl. All I wanted to do is dance. Same to this day. Like, what I care about, I love just feeling good.
Yeah.
And I feel amazing when I watch horror. I feel amazing when I laugh really hard at campy films.
Yeah.
I feel amazing when I dance to a Starship song. And I think that I just enjoyed that about that. That it wasn't always about coupling up and mm-hmm. settling down.
Right.
I wasn't at that point then. I'm not at that point now. I don't plan on ever getting to that point. And so it was nice for me to see representations that wasn't always about grabbing a U-Haul. So...
Yeah. I will say, like, in making this list, it really dawned on me that the examples that resonated most to me when I was, like, a kid, mm-hmm. and you're just sort of, like, realizing, okay, something's off here. Like, I'm not maybe like everybody else. Mm-hmm. Wasn't the movies. It was television for me. And so seeing representation on stuff like The Golden Girls or the older shows, which I always watched, so like Mary Tyler Moore or All in the Family, those are the ones that surprisingly, like when I look back, I'm like, they were sympathetic in a way that I don't know, that I think I appreciate that I had. And it was minimal. I mean, with the exception of Soap, it wasn't like a major character, but there would be storylines where you'd be like, oh.
And I think it was different because it was in your living room.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Weekly.
Yeah.
And your whole family watched it.
Yeah.
And when your family was okay mm-hmm. with, what was it, Blanche's daughter? Which is the one?
It was Blanche's brother.
Yeah.
And then I think it was.
When they always talk about Dorothy's brother wearing dresses.
Yeah.
But like, you know, when your family's kind of sitting there and they're watching some of these things too. And you're like, okay. And, you know, they just came home and she has a wife. And then you look at your family and you're like, okay.
Oh, right, like, right.
They didn't freak out. Okay, maybe.
Yeah. It's interesting the power that media has, because I think it definitely does have the power to shape how others see us and maybe how we see ourselves as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a good point too about the television.
Thanks for listening, you guys, and we will talk to you later.
Bye. Bye.
When I just want to watch